exploring these perceptions. Of impermanent, unreliable, not self. We see what's in the way, the perceptions of permanent, reliable self. And how those misperceptions pull us right into the experience of suffering. That second arrow, the reactivity. And so it really is founded on these misperceptions that suffering comes to be. The Buddha has a teaching on a detailed description of how from this fundamental misunderstanding, ignorance, suffering happens. The dependent co-arising of suffering. Primarily, this teaching, which I'm sure many of you have heard of many times, 12 links in a chain that describe the process of suffering in our minds. Ignorance conditions mental formations. Conditions, consciousness. Conditions, body and mind processes. Conditions, the six sense bases. Conditions, contact with those sense bases. Conditions, feeling. Conditions craving, conditions clinging, conditions becoming, conditions birth, conditions aging and death, the whole mass of suffering. And the name of this teaching, dependent co-arising, independence on this that arises. Not causal, but a dependency in effect. And also I think an important piece is this co-arising piece. Suffering co-arises with ignorance. Suffering co-arises with these misperceptions. And that is the driver in so many ways. The ignorance shaping our choices, our condition, our actions, our perceptions, our feelings. These misperceptions shaping suffering. This chain can be understood as a cycle, It's not just a one-way street, but that the suffering tends to further condition more misunderstanding. The way our mind habitually responds to suffering reinforces the misperceptions, the misunderstandings. So this teaching, and the Buddha does describe it as a teaching, I think we can perhaps distinguish some of the Buddha's words into practices, things to explore through mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta being one of those kind of practices, the practices of metta. There are practices the Buddha offered to support our seeing things as they are. And then there are other teachings that are more a description of things as they are. And that's how I think of this teaching. The teaching describing how suffering comes to be, our habitual, when these misperceptions are active, when we don't understand the nature of suffering. This is a description of what happens in the mind. It's not so much described as a practice. I mean, it's what our minds tend to do. And there is a very great power to having it described so that we can see it at work. And that would be the practice associated with this, seeing these processes at work. It is such a clear description of how suffering arises. And some of the power of this description to me is the way we can see ourselves in it, in this teaching the Buddha named 2,600 years ago. It describes a human process, not personal. We are not alone in this process creating suffering. And so it can support maybe a little bit of, right, it's not all about me. This is a universally human process at work that is connected to so much of the suffering in the world. Seeing it in one mind, in this mind, there's a lot of power to that. Because the seeing of it helps to weaken the ignorance that underlies that whole pattern. And we can see it's sort of an impersonal phenomenon. Maybe that can help us to settle back and witness it more. Sometimes it is our own taking things personally, our own feeling like, well, this messiness in this mind is, nobody else has this. We each have our own unique expression of it, but it comes into this similar kind of pattern. Another part that's useful to reflect on this teaching as a whole is the relationship between these links, each of these aspects, is the word conditions, feeling conditions craving. For instance, that link between feeling and craving. It's not a causal link. And so that's an important recognition, understanding. This is not locked into causality. Conditions, the conditioned nature means that new conditions can shift the course of the unfolding. And that's part of the whole reason the Buddha taught this, to help us, in effect, the seeing or the hearing of this teaching is a condition that helps the mind to see it, which is a condition that helps the mind to see through that ignorance at the head of the chain. When the condition of ignorance is not arising, the rest of the thing falls apart. So in our habitual state of mind, in our habitual way of engaging, when we are caught by greed, caught by aversion, caught by delusion, this cycle is reinforcing itself, just cementing those conditions. That statement, whatever one frequently ponders, becomes the inclination of the mind, is kind of an expression of this. And yet new conditions, different conditions, hearing the Dhamma is a condition that can change the course, change the direction of this. Engaging with practices, curiosity about mindfulness, completely shift the unfolding of this chain. I think it's also helpful to recognize that this chain, which describes how suffering is created, also is a description of the process by which the sense of self is created. The same process is the creation of suffering that is the creation of the sense of self. They're not different processes. At different times we might know the suffering more, or other times we might know the sense of self more. But whatever is kind of predominant in our experience, it's this same process that we can be witnessing. So this description of the way the mind produces suffering is a description of the way the mind also creates identity, creates a sense of self. And so in a way it ties together these two misperceptions. The perception about how suffering is created, the clinging to something unreliable, creating the experience of suffering. So this entire chain really weaves together in some ways all three of these perceptions. How anicca, dukkha, and anatta. It points to how anicca, dukkha, and anatta are connected. I've said several times in some of the groups, mostly I think, that they're not separate. It's almost like just looking through different lenses at where the misunderstanding is. because of impermanence, there is nothing reliable. And this process of believing there is a way for the mind to control experience, to find something reliable, the way the mind kind of lands in that resistance to unreliability, the process by which we try to control that unreliability is the same process as the process of the sense of self. It's that I, me, mine, who feels like they need to control, fix, change. And so the exploration of this in our own experience, the exploration of this aspects of this chain, helps the mind to cultivate the perceptions of impermanent, unreliable, not self. So it's kind of a lens through which we can strengthen those perceptions, strengthen those understandings. So this teaching is complex, 12 links, lots of feedback loops in there, and the Buddha acknowledged this. He acknowledged how complex it is, how profound, and how hard it is to understand. At one point, Ananda came to the Buddha. Ananda was one of the Buddha's main attendants and heard most of his teachings, and he is one of the main reasons why we have the records of what the Buddha taught, because he had such a good memory. And he came to the Buddha and he said, with a kind of enthusiasm, I love this teaching on dependent origination. It's so profound, it's so amazing, and it seems so clear to me. And the Buddha said, "Don't say that, Ananda." He said, "Yes, it is profound. And yet, it is not easy to see. It is through not seeing this that beings are..." I'll read this part. It's... "This dependent origination is profound and appears profound. It is through not understanding, not penetrating this teaching, that this generation has become like a tangled ball of string, covered as with a blight, tangled with like coarse grass, unable to pass beyond states of woe." So it's, we're probably not going to get it today. But I will make an attempt to offer some reflections on this, on these links. Where I like to start this teaching, it's my own personal preference, is not with the very first one. I mean, I've talked a little bit about how the ignorance is kind of the thing that kind of sends us off. But these first few links, ignorance, conditions, mental formations, conditions, consciousness, those are like some of the hardest to understand, hardest to talk about. So it's a hard place to start this talk. So I'll start where it's a little easier. And start in a place where it's perhaps easier to see in our direct experience. The place where it's easiest to see in our direct experience is, and you've seen this. I mean, you have seen aspects of this unfolding in your practice. And so this is where we can start. It's like, okay, yeah, we got a body, we got a mind. Body and mind are aware. We can kind of start there. And because we have this body and mind and we have these six sense bases, so we can start there with the six sense bases. And because there's consciousness connected with those sense bases, there is sense contact. There's sight, there's sound, there's smell, there's taste, there's touch, there's things arising in the mind. So this is pretty basic. You've all been seeing this, talking about this, reporting things you've noticed about this. And so there's sense impression. And each sense impression, this is contact. That's the link contact. So six sense bases conditions contact. Every single contact, every single sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, everything that arises in the mind, all sense impressions have a feeling tone. This is contact, conditions, feeling. Feeling tone, simple feeling tone, simple aspect of experience, just whether experience is pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Very simple quality of experience that every single sense contact has this one of these three flavors. This feeling tone it's not inherent in the sense impression. The feeling tone is conditioned. It is conditioned somewhat based on our history, you know, the sometimes a long history, sometimes it's just immediate history. So for instance, for some people, the taste of milk might be pleasant after eating a chocolate chip cookie. But just imagine in this moment just what it's like to have a cup of milk or a sip of milk after you've had a pickle. Different experience, probably not pleasant. So the feeling, the experience of the feeling of contact is conditioned based on many things. So that's a kind of an immediate example, but you know, other examples like I did not grow up eating tofu and tempeh. And initially, the experience of tofu and tempeh were unpleasant. Just the conditions of my life had not introduced me to those flavors or ways of eating them. And so there's kind of long-range conditions and near-range conditions that affect this feeling tone. It's not inherent in tofu that it is pleasant or unpleasant. It is based on many conditions, how it is experienced in this moment. The arising of sense impression is said to happen with every sense experience for all beings. So even the Buddha experienced pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral after he no longer experienced suffering, no longer experienced this second arrow. There was still the arising of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. It is said that he at times had to ask some of his followers to give a talk because his back was too painful and he had to go lie down. So he experienced unpleasant, pleasant and neutral. And so this is not something within this life that goes away. It is a kind of a condition, a basic condition of human life that this arises. Based on this feeling tone, our habitual response to that, our habitual way of relating. And this is, again, based on many conditions from the past. It's based on conditions from the past plus the condition of being born a human being. Our tendency is to move towards the pleasant, away from the unpleasant. To like the pleasant, not like the unpleasant. So we've got this kind of almost automatic, very, very deeply conditioned response to pleasant and unpleasant. And so based on feeling, based on pleasant, we tend to like it. We want more of that. Crave more pleasant. Unpleasant, we tend to crave not that. So this is that next link. Feeling tone tends to condition or conditions craving. This habit, this pattern of wanting, not wanting. The neutral feeling tone, when not seen, can condition boredom, spacing out, disconnection, unawareness. And so this feeling conditions craving. And, you know, just to bring back a little bit of the beginning of the cycle, feeling conditions craving when ignorance is co-arising. So when ignorance is present, when the misperception about, in this case probably more about reliability, misperception about the unreliability of feeling tone. We think that the kind of the control around feeling tone, getting this thing, will make me happy. This misperception, that delusion, that misperception around there is something reliable, is driving that feeling to craving. And so the movement, that condition, feeling conditions craving, arises in dependence on that misunderstanding. But it is a very deep and habitual misunderstanding. And we all see it. We see it all the time, this movement. Yeah, oh, like that, want more of that. Oh, good sitting, can I have more of those, thank you. Sitting's not the way I like it. How come it's not like yesterday's? Suffering. So that feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, tends to lead to craving. Craving then conditions once we, you know, when we like something, want something, there's a kind of a movement towards it. And the next link is kind of almost an intensification of the craving. Craving conditions clinging. And so the mind with the pleasant experience kind of leans towards it. That's the wanting. And then it kind of like reaches out and goes, yeah, got it. Landed on it. That's the clinging. Bhikkhu Bodhi describes this distinction through an analogy of a thief. When they're in a house getting ready to, you know, looking for things to steal. So they see something they want. And the wanting is kind of like they're reaching for that thing. And the clinging is when they picked it up. It's on a scale. It's an intensification of that movement of craving. It's like, and the delusion, the misunderstanding believes that yes, the having, the clinging, the having is what is going to make me happy. And so that leads again to this clinging. once something is clung to, the next link is becoming. So clinging conditions becoming. And I like Thanissaro Bhikkhu's definition of this. His phrase is that once something is clung to, our intentions and our actions kind of rally in the service of that clinging. Like, yeah, okay, got this thing, now how do I keep it? How do I hold it? How do I make sure it stays mine? So this becoming is connected to this movement in the direction of identity, being. So this becoming is kind of the intentions, the actions, the movements that serve the clinging. So when we cling to something, there's this movement towards, okay, how do I keep this? Or how do I keep that at bay? We like this experience of clinging. It's kind of the mind kind of headed in this direction. Okay, yep, this is how I'm going to control this. This is how I'm going to make sure this works. That's that mind of becoming. It's the mind that has the idea of control and believes that is going to bear fruit and is going to make me happy. So the mind in that place of becoming thinks it's figured it out, thinks it's figured out the deal. And then the next link is birth. We actually take birth in that identity. I have it. I have figured it out. It's mine. I'm in control. I've got it. And so this, in a way, at least my understanding of this distinction between becoming and birth is kind of akin to the distinction between wanting and clinging. It's an intensification, in a way, of the movement in the direction of identity. So with the craving and clinging, it's the movement towards the holding on. And in this case, the becoming and the birth, it's like the heading in the direction of, I know what I'm going to be doing, and then the landing there. I am this. I am doing this. So we do like becoming. It can feel like we know, we understand, we figured it out, we're in control. And in birth, when we take birth in an identity, immediately that birth kind of begins to prove or to point to its kind of vulnerability because of impermanence, because of unreliability. There is no way to maintain that control and to stay fixed there and to stay landed there. That, yeah, I have figured it out. Well, maybe for a split second the mind can land there and have some sense of, oh, that's good. But almost immediately it starts shifting and changing. And so with birth, once there is a birth into some kind of an identity, immediately kind of the nature of impermanence takes over. And the inevitable result of that taking, holding into an identity, becoming an I, or a me, or a mine, something is mine, is that that identity will fade. And the next link is, based on this birth, based on birth into some kind of identity, aging and death of that identity follows. And this also does refer to literal birth and literal death, but there are ways in the text that it does seem to point to this more process of identification and the unreliable, impermanent nature of identification, of identities being the aging and death of the identities. And from there, the Buddha says, suffering. This is suffering. Actually, it seems to me that based on what I mentioned the other day, what Gil pointed out about the second noble truth, the different articulation of that with the arising of craving is the arising of suffering. Suffering has already come to be as soon as craving springs in. As soon as that's there, there is already suffering. And yet our minds kind of continue on this chain, solidifying and cementing the identities and the patterns and the habits. And it's like the craving just propels this whole movement in the direction of me, I am. And the whole part of that chain, from craving on, is already suffering. I'd like to pause here and just reflect back on this birth, this identification, this sense of self peace. How it's experienced in ways that we see it or can see it. We're familiar, very familiar, I think, with the sense impressions, the wanting, that sense of craving, the clinging. Maybe a little bit of the sense of the movement of, ooh, I want to control something. But I'd like to just reflect for a few moments. This has come up in the groups a couple of times, and so bringing it in, I think bringing it into the hall at this point seems useful. So the Buddha has a very repetitive teaching that he offers around seeing things as they are. He says, we should see with proper wisdom as it actually is. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. And so he's got these three flavors or three kind of perspectives of the sense of self. As I reflected on this in my own practice, I understood the sense of mine. That seems, and in a way, I think the order here is indicative of something, kind of a more and more subtle flavors of self. So the first one, this is not mine, is pointing to undermining the owner, the one who takes possession of things. That's a very obvious kind of sense of self. That's mine. My sitting spot. Why is somebody in my sitting spot? My cup. You know, we own things, even like, you know, that aren't ours. So there's that flavor of the sense of self. The second one he points to is this I am not. The distinction that I'd like to offer here is my understanding of these last two. I've talked to other teachers, and there are different ways to understand these three. But this is a way that has been useful in my own practice in seeing something about the selfing. And so I offer it as a reflection and a way to look at different aspects of the sense of self. But I don't know what the Buddha meant by the distinction between these last two. I just know that this understanding has been useful in my own practice. And so I'm not claiming that this is what the Buddha said, but just that this may be useful. So the second one is this I am not. And that one, to me, points to the I am kind of sense of self. This one's also more familiar to us in many ways. It is this, I am the doer. I am the one who acts, who chooses, who responds, who thinks, who engages. And so it is this sense of self that is very active, the sense of self that feels control, perhaps. That's a sense of self that several of you have talked about, that sense of feeling like that sense of I need to have control, or feeling like I am in control, or I don't want to let go of control. So that flavor is also a little more obvious and seems to come and go somewhat. You know, we have times when we really want to have that control, and other times when it can be more like, yeah, it's okay, I can just let things be. So that's that second one, or a way to look at that second one, is that sense of self that is the agent. The way this is languaged, this I am not, puts the sense of self as the subject of the sentence. I do, I act, I respond, I engage, I choose, I decide, I'm in control. So it's the subject of the sentence, the sense of self that is the subject of the sentence. And then this third one, this is not myself. This is more of the self as receiver, as kind of the object of the sentence, me. Well, you know, the difference between I do and me being the hapless recipient of whatever comes. There have been times in my practice where it was very clear that I wasn't in control of anything that was happening. That notion, that aspect of not self was very clear. Yeah, who's doing this perceiving? Who's doing this consciousness? I'm not doing any of this. But it sure felt like it was happening to me. That's that third level that maybe is being pointed to, and this is not myself. This is the sense of, I see I'm not in control, but it feels like me. This is a more pervading kind of feeling. It seems to be present so much. It's not obvious as much like the I'm doing, I'm acting, I'm the analytical, right, know how to ask questions in the hall, 40-year-old, or it's not that quality, it's much more subtle. There are times when it can be just useful to recognize, yep, that's the feeling of me. This is not something we usually can turn off. But again, the witnessing, the curiosity, the recognition, this is the experience of a human being feeling like me. Just know that. There may be times in the witnessing that it weakens or even falls away entirely. And then there becomes a little bit more of the understanding of how that me operates, how that feeling of me operates. So essentially in the practice around dependent origination, we are curious about wherever we arrive, wherever we arise, whatever is being known. And so, you know, if we're feeling like we're sitting in a sense of me, kind of haplessly being buffeted around by sensations and sounds and sights and thoughts, it's like, well, that's the experience. That can be known. So this cycle around feeling, wanting, craving, clinging, becoming, kind of reinforces itself in a way that we explored the other day, that when that wanting arises, that feeling of, so there's a pleasant experience, an unpleasant experience, we want it, we don't want it. So there is, you know, there is that kind of movement there. You know, so when we act out on that, we want something, we get it, in the moment of the getting of it, there is the kind of the double hit of, ah, got this thing. And that unpleasant quality of craving has gone away. So simultaneously, there's kind of a double hit of pleasant when we get something that we want or get rid of something that we don't want. So if we kind of are curious about the feeling tone of the links themselves, so craving is unpleasant. Becoming is pleasant. We feel like we figured it out. We get both the, in that moment, we get both the sense of the association with what we want. We get the feeling of being in control, and that wanting goes away. It all is reinforcing. Okay, the next, you know, when was the last time I felt good? It was when I got something that I wanted. And so it tends to perpetuate the cycle there. So given that this whole chain kind of describes a whole cycle, going back to we've ended up with suffering, that suffering tends to condition ignorance, tends to condition more misperceptions, based mostly on our conditioning, based mostly on the last time I felt pretty good was when I got something I wanted. Feeling pretty bad now, so maybe get something that I want. So we are just propelled by that experience of landing in dukkha to find our only way, the only way we tend to know out of it, which is, again, to get something that we want, which sends us around that chain again. And so the experience of suffering tends to condition, or does at times condition, more ignorance, more misperception. It doesn't have to. If we actually become aware of suffering, if we notice that, it's like, oh, this is suffering. If instead of following on our habitual tendencies with suffering, we actually, oh, this is the human experience of suffering, a whole different process can unfold. Faith can arise. Curiosity. The mind can move in the direction of freedom. So this suffering tends to reinforce our misperceptions. We kind of double down on our misperceptions and think, well, that didn't work so well, but maybe if I try again. And so it reinforces that ignorance. And with ignorance as a condition, with these misperceptions as a condition, the next link is mental formations come to be. So our choices, our actions, the ways that we engage in the world are shaped by those misperceptions. Taking things to be permanent, reliable, controllable, shapes the way we act, the way we think, the way we choose, what we decide to do. Usually taking the most obvious route to get me out of this suffering, get me to the next pleasant hit, the next getting rid of the unpleasant. And again, reinforcing that cycle. And so the misperceptions shape how we engage. Now, these misperceptions, we talked about this the other day, these misperceptions and with delusion, different levels of these, the way misperception works, not only at the human level, and not only at our personal level. So, you know, this description at times can sound like this is, you know, just the unfolding of our own little cycle, our own little chain in here. But this, the views, the conditioning that we have, the perspectives of taking what is permanent, impermanent to be permanent, unreliable to be reliable, not self to be self, we seem to be born with those. But there are many other views that condition us, ignorance that conditions us, perspectives that come from our culture, like the historical conditioning that we have. And this, you know, we do not live in isolation. Our ignorance is shaped a lot by our collective experience. We don't create these views out of whole cloth. We inherit them from our families, from our cultures. And they're hard to see as views at times. And you know, we swim at these in these views. We aren't aware of what it's like to be, in my case, you know, that this kind of waking up around what it's like to be a white, heterosexual female in this culture. You know, what is it like? I mean, it's like, how do I touch that experience? It's so hidden. So this kind of ignorance, the view of whiteness and the view of what it means, the view of any identity we have and what it means, is these are all shaped not only by our own experience, but by our culture, our conditioning. And these, you know, mental formations, beliefs, views, they shape our responses to the world. They shape how we engage, what we believe about each other, what we believe about ourselves. And a lot of suffering comes from misperceptions, misunderstandings that these are views and not truths. So much suffering comes from these collective mental formations that we just inherit. And I feel it is our kind of our responsibility to expose them, to begin to recognize what are these beliefs we're carrying from our history, from our past, and how does it make us believe we can engage in the world or can't engage in the world? What's okay for me to do, what's not okay for me to do, based on so much of this history. So these mental formations condition how we take in the world. So mental formations condition consciousness. This is a very active shaping of consciousness. It is, these views, these beliefs, our filters, basically, based on these views, these beliefs, these filters, we become aware, I'll use conscious now instead of awareness, we become conscious of certain things, and we don't become conscious of other things because of these views. We are unaware that the things that our consciousness, the whole shaping of what the mind chooses to become aware of, become conscious of, is shaped by beliefs and views and patterns. Present-day psychology has a word for this. They call it confirmation bias. We tend to see what confirms our pre-existing views. And so our views shape what we pick out of the world. So our views, our beliefs, mental formations shape what we actually become conscious of. We become conscious of some things and not conscious of other things. We just do not see some things. Actually not arising in consciousness. Sometimes these filters, these beliefs and views prevent kind of some things from actually arising in consciousness. And when we're not aware that this happens, our views just reinforce themselves, essentially. And so we're close back to the beginning now with consciousness as a condition that shapes our mental and physical processes, which shapes our sense bases and what we see, what we receive. And so we can see at this point, you know, the first time through, it kind of sounds like, oh yeah, I'm just this camera. I've got sight, sound. Yep, it's pleasant. Okay, then I like it. I want it. It's like the entire thing is already pre-shaped by this ignorance, by these views. We are not coming into each moment of experience with some kind of pure meeting of a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, a touch. It is already skewed by views, opinions, maybe by some of these deeper misperceptions of there's something that's reliable, I'll find that. There's something that is permanent, where can I land? So it is possible to, knowing about this process, beginning to witness it, hearing some of this information, helps us to see this process at work, and understanding that it's conditioned, it is a conditioned process, we can take some hope in the fact that different conditions can change the mix, change the course. And the key conditions are around mindfulness and wisdom. Awareness of this, of these processes, and the hearing about the forms of misperception, the ways in which our mind tends to reinforce its own beliefs already. Hearing about that, we can begin to see these processes at work, begin to see this happening, and the awareness and wisdom can kind of put a halt to it and say, wait a minute, maybe there's something else to be seen here, rather than just following the usual habitual pattern. In terms of describing this chain, often there's the Buddha emphasized quite a bit the feeling-craving link. And in some ways that makes a lot of sense because, you know, the feeling tone is a place where even enlightened beings experience that. So always at present in every moment of experience. And the craving being the kind of the launching point of the whole suffering, with the arising of craving is the arising of suffering. And so, you know, beginning to tune into the feeling and notice that movement is a very powerful practice. And there are times when we can see just the feeling and the clear seeing of the feeling, there's not necessarily a movement, because the mind is there and seeing it and understanding, oh, this is just an impermanent feeling, kind of bursting that bubble of a reliable feeling that can be landed on. The mind just can just like, oh, a feeling coming and going. And it doesn't lead to craving. And so that is a very powerful avenue for using this teaching to help the mind see through the suffering. And yet, there are also places in the suttas that emphasize it does not matter where you wake up. The seeing, wherever it is, if you wake up in the midst of becoming and that sense of, yeah, I got it, and that feeling of the mind just in the midst of that controlling happening, and you see that, way past the feeling craving link, but, you know, so it's not hopeless in that moment. There's a teaching that points to anywhere the mindfulness comes in, wherever we see this cycle, whatever piece of this cycle we're seeing, if you can see the impermanent nature of that, the teaching says, for instance, when one understands clinging, one understands the arising of clinging, and one understands the ending of clinging, and one understands that there's a way leading to the ending of clinging, freedom can happen. And so it's not like we have to wait to find that pristine moment of just feeling. Wherever we are in this moment, whatever we're seeing, this teaching points to seeing the impermanent nature of whatever it is, a sense of self, seeing the impermanent nature of craving itself, seeing the impermanent nature of that identity, that can lead to the mind letting go. One last piece I'll offer. This describes such a profound web of conditioning, this teaching. And sometimes we might think we have to understand with something, you know, what were all the conditions that led to this? You know, like where was the feeling that this launched from, or whatever. You know, we may just feel like this is so deeply conditioned, I have to understand all of the threads that lead to it. That sometimes can happen, maybe probably not all the threads, but sometimes we can see kind of a key thread of conditioning that led to the arising of this. Self-hatred arising because of a thought and a belief in a thought. Seeing that so clearly, that arising there, the conditioning of that and how it connected with history. Sometimes we see that kind of detail of the conditioning itself. But sometimes it's sufficient to just understand that something is conditioned. That is itself very freeing. The mind doesn't have to know all of the endless roots of it. In fact, it probably can't. But recognizing this is conditioned, a very powerful understanding. Let's just sit for a moment.